Thanks for coming along. So hopefully everyone's here to talk about domain-driven development, domain events, which you may not have heard of, and unit testing, which I hope everyone's heard of. Before I get started, I just want to understand a little bit about who you guys are, because whenever you get a dev topic, sometimes you've got people who are from business, some people are application architects, some people do code most of the time. So who would here would classify themselves as, say, an architect? Okay, cool. All right. Excellent. Can you please leave the room, because you guys are going to ask too many hard questions. Who's a developer? Awesome. Okay. So this session is about domain-driven design. If you're already practicing domain-driven design, this is more of a primer session to get some of those people up to speed, but then I'm going to focus on domain events and some of the different approaches to domain events. So my question is, who's heard of domain events? Excellent. All right. So what we'll do is we'll get into it. We'll look at just some basics around DDD, and then we'll get onto the domain events. And I think that's where the interesting conversations will take place. Feel free to interrupt me. This is hopefully an interactive session. It's a pretty big crowd, but whenever you get developers talking about real sort of code and architectural issues, some of the conversation tends to be pretty good. I'm hoping I can learn some things. Hopefully I can show you some things that you haven't seen before as well. So, rough agenda. And now what I'm going to do is flick from PowerPoint to a presentation that I couldn't get onto the TechEd template. who's thankful for that? Not nearly enough people. All right. So, in case you didn't realise, my name's Mitch Denny, and I'm going to have to use my buttons here. And my role is Chief Technology Officer at Redify. What that means is they don't let me code anymore. So I get to do these presentations and tell other people how to code, as long as I promise not to commit any myself. If you want to look at some of the content I post on the web, that's my blog. That's my email address. Quite happy to take emails. Probably take me until next week to reply, given TechEd. And then if you want to follow me on Twitter or say something to me during the event, but are a little bit too scared to put up your hand, I certainly won't mock anyone for asking a question. I think this is kind of some pretty exciting stuff around application architecture, so I actually want you to ask questions, and I want to learn from you guys quite a bit. So that's the summary of me. And this is all about domain-driven design, domain events, unit testing. Now, one thing that you probably don't know about me is that I got married recently. And as a developer, I can't help thinking about how to automate things, right? So I'm going... Take that how you will. So I'm going through this wedding process, and I'm thinking, do I really need to create this spreadsheet with a million columns and tracking status of everyone? It would be great if some software existed to do this. And being a developer, I thought, great, I'm going to do that someday. And so this session is what I thought about how I would tackle doing that someday. All right, so the code I'm going to show you here is not complete code. It's just to illustrate a concept. So focus on... the topic, not so much the depth of the amount of code there. I've really sort of tried to pull it apart. This is awesome. I've got people sitting on the floor. This is like Woodstock. Okay, so hopefully I spelled ubiquitous correctly. Whenever we start talking about domain-driven design, one of the first concepts that really needs to come up is this topic of ubiquitous language. Who works for a company... or has worked, consulted, or worked, done development for a company that has multiple business divisions that do similar things? So it's like a conglomerate organisation. Okay. One of my classic samples or use cases for this sort of why this is useful is, let's say you're working for a logistics company. Now, in Australia, we have a couple of logistics companies that have sort of federated business models. What each company calls a trip and what they really mean are two completely different things. So if you're looking to build a piece of software that works across divisions, one of the first things you have to do is get everyone to agree on what the terms mean. Because if you don't do that, every time you go into some sort of design session or start gathering requirements, they're all going to be talking something that sounds like the same language, but they're all meaning completely different things. And so from a domain-driven design point of view, one of the first things you have to learn is, let's nail that language down. So when I say, you know, guest, you know what that means. Okay? When I say trip, you know what that means. This is a tool that allows you to create an intersection between the geeks and the suits. You know? So the geeks understand what the business means, and the suits kind of understand what the developers mean. But actually, interestingly, I find it's good to help the suits and the suits talk together as well, especially if they're coming from multiple different business units. So what you end up with is these terms and some kind of definition of those terms. It doesn't really matter where you put this information, just make it somewhere available to the entire team, everyone who's involved with the project. So that when you go into those design sessions and you talk about the way the software is going to work, that you can point in that and say, well, when you said guest, is this your definition of guest or are we talking about something else? Because that will drive the design of your software. It'll help you seek clarity in your design. Once you've got this almost like a dictionary mapped out for your software in terms of the things you're dealing with, what you need to do is figure out what's in scope and out of scope, if you will. And so when you talk about domain-driven design, one of the concepts that comes up is bounded context. So I might be building an application which is all about managing invitations to a wedding. And even though the ubiquitous language mentions things like gift registries, my application is not interested in that. So we put that off in a separate context. It's over there. We know what it is. We've defined it, but we don't have to build it. All right, so we draw boundaries around what we're going to build in this side of the application. And that's very useful when you're trying to stop yourself continuing to design and model things which aren't going to be useful within your application. Who's with me so far? Yeah. If you haven't been married yet, and this is all seeming pretty strange, you'll be pretty familiar with it, I'm sure, by the time you go through your first wedding. You might be pulling your hair out. Okay. Now, if you don't put some boundaries around the complexity of your domain model, this is what you're going to end up with. A big, complicated mess. So defining the terms and saying what's in scope and out of scope around your problem is actually just as important as doing the development itself. You really want to exclude as much as possible so that it can really simplify your design. Don't get married yet. Yeah, it's true, yeah. I'm sure some people would agree with you. I might too sometimes. Now, once you've got that sort of basic set of principles down, now what you need to do is start doing the proper modelling of your application. Now, this isn't something where you spend 6 months doing a modelling exercise before you start writing code. Feel free to start playing around with the API and exploring the problem early, right? Because it'll actually help show up holes in your architecture and scope. Don't not do development. So you want to evolve your design. So one of the first terms that we're going to come across is this concept called an entity. Does anyone want to take a stab at defining what an entity is? And so there's some kind of way to identify me, right, which is independent of all those attributes, right? So exactly right. So the concept of an identity is something that has a lifetime of its own and it has some kind of identity mapped to it, right? So we start talking pretty quickly about keys and we can get into conversations about what the best key for some particular entity is, you know, GUIDs, integers, you know, rego numbers. Doesn't really matter. The key point is it should be unique to be able to uniquely identify that entity. Okay, so that's one term you need to be introduced to. The next term that we need to talk about is this concept called a value object. So anyone want to take a stab at a value object? Since I've got everyone else doing the work here. Doesn't have persistence. Okay, well, so what would be the value of something that you didn't persist? So when we're talking about entities, we're talking about things that had identity of their own. A value object is really the sum of all of the its values. So a value object such as a date of birth is, you know, the day, month, year, which represents the date of birth, but there's no, you know, identity A for a particular date of birth. So it's data that has no lifetime of its own. It's always attached to an entity. So I'll talk about this, but in summary, don't confuse the concept of value object from a DDD concept and value type as, say, a CLR type. They're two. So it's immutable. Yeah, and you don't change those values independently. So if you wanted to change those values, you have to completely reassign it to be a completely separate object. Yeah, okay. Probably more of an implementation concern, because there's probably a couple of different ways to skin that cat in terms of your and it will depend a little bit on the languages that you're using as well, still how you approach that. But I guess what I wanted to make the distinction between is with an entity, you've got some concept of an identity. With a value object, the data is the object. Yeah? And so if you change, say, the year, it's a completely different object. And so often, you know, value types inside .NET are represented like value objects, but not necessarily. So if you confuse those two, you're kind of doing it wrong. I just like that picture. Okay, the next topic we're going to talk about is aggregates. So aggregates are where you've got an entity and you've decided that when you go and fetch data from your persistence layer, because in DDD one of the things we want to practice is some kind of persistence ignorance, not the expense of complexity necessarily. That's kind of the unit of data fetching that we use. So if we're talking about the wedding scenario, I might decide that I want to pull back all of the data for a wedding, right? So I would have an aggregate route called wedding and would have the guests that sort of hang off that. So an aggregate is one entity which has other entities and value objects hanging off it, and it's what we use to persist that data or get that data from some external system through a repository. It's probably the easiest way of thinking about it. There is the domain-driven design book has quite decent definitions. I've tried to pick the eyes out to get the essence of what they are. But I would actually recommend that if you're going to start practicing domain-driven design, grab the book, because it kind of introduces you to the topic, but then you're going to want to go and get another book which talks about, you know, your particular technology that you're using. Okay. And first of all, play with it yourself. So if we look at an object model, this is a really simple object model related to that ubiquitous language that I defined, that this is part of the bounded context that we're playing with. We can see here that we've got two relatively important entities. We've got the concept of a guest and we've got the concept of a wedding. Those things kind of operate independently of each other. I might decide to fetch the guest independently. So the question we've got is, which one would you make the aggregate route? Would you make both of them an aggregate route? You know, I don't know, this is part of the design bit of object-oriented design. You need to actually think through what scenario you're going to be using with this object model. Are you always, when you perform actions against it, are you always going to start with the wedding, or are you going to start with the guest? All right. Anyone want to take a guess as to which one you'd do? And reasons? Yeah, that's certainly true. The guest relies on the wedding. What if my problem domain said that we tracked guests across multiple weddings? Would that change your decision? Right, so once you start analysing the problem, it impacts your design. And this is the whole thing about domain-driven design. There's no sort of recipe where you're shaking all these terms and it says, here is your object model. You actually have to think through the problem that you're solving. But you use this as a sort of a framework to sort of classify those objects or those entities that you're dealing with. Yeah, so the general rule, there's a couple of rules of thumb, but one of the rules that is often touted is that you shouldn't directly access or shouldn't directly hold a reference to an entity which is not an aggregate root. But there's a problem with that in that most applications are asynchronous in nature, so you kind of do some processing, you send some data out, you need to find a way to get back to that object when that processing completes, which might be a couple of days later. A really good example is sending an email. So if I send out a wedding invitation, so I visit this website, it sends out an email, and that email contains a URL which has the wedding ID and some kind of invitation ID, which might be the guest ID. Does that break that rule where I'm holding a reference to the entity which is sitting off the aggregate root, which is the wedding? Well, the answer is it's kind of like a foreign key. You might consider it to be breaking the rule, but I'd like to see you write the software any other way. Right. So you could kind of do RSVPs and guess who's responding, but I wouldn't recommend it. So that's kind of one of the important things to remember about domain-driven design. Don't go all purist, right? Think practically about what you're trying to achieve. Okay. So we've got some rules of thumb. It's the first one I mentioned before. Entities with an aggregate should only reference the root entity of other aggregates. Given that, you might actually end up promoting some aggregates to aggregate roots, or some entities to aggregates. It's just reality, right? The whole idea behind domain-driven design and these terms we've introduced is to make complex software more approachable. If it's not making it more approachable, consider breaking some rules or bending some rules a little bit to make your software more maintainable or easier. And it's actually okay to hold on, particularly when you're crossing bounded contexts. So I'm, say, going from the wedding invite context to the gift registry context, to hold on to some kind of key between those things. Because otherwise, how do you relate the data? So I might have the wedding ID inside my gift registry. But other than that, those two models are completely independent. It might hold the guest IDs as well, but there's no tight coupling in terms of object references. If you do flex the rules, if you've got to do it all the time, maybe you've got your aggregates wrong. There's a few sort of common sense moments. And if you're having a lot of trouble figuring out what entities are an aggregate, think about, if I wanted to delete an object, what would I want to go with it? Helps you figure out what that object hierarchy is. Right? Not always the case, but if you're having trouble, that often works. Has anyone ever knew what that term rule of thumb came from? Apparently it's an urban myth. I actually did some research. Who would do that anyway? Anyway. Okay, so then we get on to repository. So we've sort of covered a little bit of territory now around domain-driven design, and we're starting to understand how that domain model starts to plug into persistence. Because whilst we say we want to practice persistence ignorance with domain-driven design, at some point you've got to get data down into some kind of store. And so if you've come up with your aggregates, you can kind of come up with what your repositories are going to be within the scaffolding of your application. Well, you've kind of answered your own question, because what does the business want to have happen? If, from my point of view, I might change my address, but I might decide that I want the bank to continue sending my bank statements to a particular location. So you start to explore your problem domain a little bit more. You say, okay, is that just an address, or is that a postal address, right? Or is that a residential address? So you actually start to break it out a little bit. And the other thing is that, it comes down to, the bank's policy. If the bank's policy is that the customer must always provide their residential address as their postal address, then you might change all of that data at once, or you might decide to keep them completely separate. It becomes an interesting thing. Is an address a value object? Yeah, and in some designs, the answer might be yes. In some designs, the answer might be no. You might have a unique ID for every particular address because you use some kind of address resolution service, for example.
With the repositories, so I can understand that it's the mechanism to access data.
Yep.
But with a lot of ORMs, the stuff goes hand-to-hand to ORMs,
mm-hmm.
you have latent copies of lazy loading where you hit a property and it will be full-loaded automatically.
Yep.
In which case, not going through a repository to get that. Does that break the rule?
Not really, because that implementation should ideally be hidden. So typically the way those ORMs work is that you'll expose, say, a collection of an object with a virtual method. And so when the ORM instantiates that object, it'll actually put in its own lazy loading collection. So when you hit that, it'll actually pull the data back, hopefully in some optimal way. You've got to be a little bit careful. But the ORM should hide that implementation detail from you. What you've got to watch out for is, Entity Framework's a good one for this, and Hibernate kind of has similar issues. They all kind of tackle the problem in a similar way, is that you start leaking your ORM abstraction into your domain model. And I've got an opinion about this, which is, and I'll probably expand a little bit more later on. If the way it's leaking into your domain model is through some sort of standard, say, .NET convention, say the data annotation stuff, which you can expect to be used across the platform in multiple places, it's not such a problem. But if it's something that's very, very specific to the ORM, and that attribute only makes sense in the ORM, and it changes the behavior of the object when it's going through the ORM versus some maybe in-memory provider, then that's a problem. You've got to remember, the repositories exist not just to talk to ORMs and databases, but they might be shielding from some sort of legacy back-end system as well. And you do want to be able to plug and change them over time. I do it on a fairly regular basis. Okay. One takeaway that I think you really need to have there is don't necessarily have a repository for every entity. All right? Think about, if you need to access that entity, then maybe it should have been an aggregate in the first place. If not, is there some other way you can load that through the aggregate by passing some sort of key around, or is it some sort of parameterization in the URL? Oops. Okay. So let's get in. I've got some demo code. I've got sort of five sort of samples sort of evolving over time. So I'll jump between them and these slides, and we'll just talk through some of the code. So this first one, I'm just going to introduce an application with some basic scaffolding. Okay, so it's not a complex application. So jump down here to Visual Studio. So what I've got here is a .NET solution. I've got a web application. I've got a class library which has my domain model. You can see there that you've got some of the objects from that bounded context that I had. Now, I've decided in this particular design that my aggregate root is the wedding object. That's the way I'm accessing it. I could have sliced it another way if I wanted to, but that's what I chose to in this particular case. So that's my, it's my repository, and inside my web application, I've got some fairly simple code just for bringing up get information about guests and weddings and creating weddings and that kind of stuff. So there's nothing in here that's that unusual from a code-based point of view. Now, when I run this application, just so we're all familiar with what it does, when I run this application and select the right startup project, you can see that it presents no authentication in this thing. We've got a list of upcoming weddings. Do you like my design skills? So what I can do here is I can actually create a new wedding. I think these guys should have always got together. Obviously not that many Drew Carey fans in the audience. Okay, and I create the object. And so there, my data is stored. Now, at the moment, I'm not actually touching the database. I've just got an in-memory wedding repository. All right? So if I shut down this application, all the data's reset. Now, what I want to do is go and invite someone to the wedding. So I've done all this implementation. We'll explore the actual code in a second. And so I can go and invite a guest. Sort of mixing my television and the movies here a little bit. I can click invite. Now, when I click this button, the code's going to crash because this code actually goes and sends an email. Okay? And here's a tip. Who's ever used a program called Papercut? Yep, it's awesome, isn't it? So if you're doing local development and you've got code that needs to send email, this is like a desktop email server, right? You receive the emails and you just have a quick glance at what's going on in those messages that are coming out. I can't stand having to deal with production systems in terms of sending emails. I just want to have a nice self-contained development environment. So this program, you can download, run it, and allows you to look at the emails. So now, when I click invite, there's the email. And if I look at the body of the email, you can see that it's generated a URL. It's a bit rude. You know, it doesn't even say, hey, come to our wedding. It just says, here's a URL, right? This is why, you know, as a developer, you imagine all this software, it's going to be awesome, and then you completely fail on usability. So anyway, so I'll take that URL, and I'll paste it into a browser, because it doesn't hyperlink it in that viewer. And then all I have to do is say, yep, I'm going to be attending the wedding. Once again, a masterpiece of user interface. And so now if I go back and I refresh this view, it'll say that James Edwards has not responded, and now he's attending. So basic workflow within the application. Pretty simple. Now, if I look at the code that's behind that, when I invite, apologies for the screen res, when I invite the guest to the wedding, I go and fetch the wedding based on the ID, and on the wedding object, I call invite guest. So I'm not instantiating the wedding object and inserting it, I actually am sort of governing some business rules through that wedding object. So I provide some details and then I save the repository. So really the real important piece of code is this one line here. So how does the email get sent? Well, if I go and jump in to the invite guest method, you can see that I'm actually instantiating this SMTP email invitation service. So all of a sudden, this code that I've got, this really nice code I've got, it's got an external dependency on email. This domain model, you don't want that. You want your domain model to be able to operate independently of that internal infrastructure code. Because now I can't exercise this domain model in a unit test without actually going and hitting an SMTP server. So you'd want to try and avoid that. The problem is, if I jump back here, let me just jump down here. What you want to do is avoid this situation. I could externalize that dependency by passing it into the constructors of the domain object. but I still haven't removed that knowledge of external dependencies from my code, even though I've probably made it more testable. So it's something you need to think about. That's an external service, right? It's an external email dispatch is like an external dependency. But something that's 100% internal to the business logic of the application, like a tax calculation engine for paying for it as the invitations go out, that's kind of internal to the application. In this case, it might just be something as simple as a static method, right? It's part of the business logic, part of the problem domain. So you need to sort of figure out, is it an external dependency or is it part of the domain, and do I need to model it as part of the domain? You know, does my wedding invitation application require a tax calculation engine as a separate entity even? Probably not, but it's just a simple piece of code. But it's probably not an external dependency. Okay. So that's where domain events come in. Domain events allow you to look at your domain model and push all of those external dependencies to the outside and come up with a way of communicating with them fairly simply. So jump back to my code here. Okay. So what I've done is I've got my service here, so it's pretty much the same code. And there are really three different approaches of doing domain events that I've seen out there in the wild. One is to use plain old .NET events. That is where you just fire an event, you've got some code in your infrastructure somewhere listening for that event, and it goes and takes some kind of action. You've got an approach called a class called Domain Events developed by Udi Dan, which actually tries to deal with some of the nasties of that approach with plain old .NET events. And the third one is one called is using the reactive framework, which I think is quite nice in a lot of cases. So let's go and explore them. So this is the .NET events version. And if we look at the wedding object and we scroll down to when we invite the guest, instead of actually calling the email service directly, what we do is we simply instantiate a guest invited event and we raise that event, plain old .NET events, right? In the controller, when we start processing the request down here, I pass in the email invitation service as a dependency to the controller. I could potentially wire this up in the global ASIX as well. There's a couple of decision points that you might touch on there, depending on which one you want to do. And I wire up to the guest invited event, and so when I send the email, when I invite the guest, the email will be sent, but my domain model still doesn't know anything about the email service. So that's better, right? The problem is you've got to keep track of where you've wired up to the events to make sure you unwire them in the right place. Who's ever dealt with memory leaks in, say, a Windows Forms application or a WPF application, right? It's the same problem. It can happen in ASP.NET, it can happen in Windows Forms. It's a burden, right? And so by doing the .NET events approach, you need to be extra careful. Okay. Okay. So let's look at Udi Dan's code. So the way Udi Dan does it is he defines this marker class iDomain event, and he's got this helper code, which I think I've opened the right one. Basically, you can. That's the wrong code. I think I'll give me a few seconds. Okay, so glad I had changed control. I might have just copied the wrong file, that's all. Okay. Even with 8 gig of RAM, you get to about, you know, 7 instances of Visual Studio running, and I think it tends to bog down a little bit. Okay, so let's go into the domain model. And there we go. We have this class called Domain Events. And this looks like kind of like a utility class. And the idea is that you register handlers against particular events, and then from within your domain model, you can raise those events. Okay. And the idea is that it's supposed to be a little bit easier to handle versus event handlers, because you get this sort of object that you can sort of unsubscribe specifically. The code works exactly the same way, though. So I run up the application, and I make exactly the same mistake. Wow, look at that. Okay. Too funny. I like ReSharp so much I installed it 10 times, yeah. Okay, so I go and create a new event. Same sort of deal, I create the object. And I go and invite a guest. And there's my message. But this time, no dependencies on the email invitation service, and less chance of me stuffing up my own code by not unsubscribing the event properly, in theory. Okay. But that's just one way of doing it. Now, who's actually heard of UDDAM before in terms of... Okay, cool. All right. One of the things that I think is worth talking about, that's UDDAM if you haven't seen his picture before, is what are the triggers for determining whether what you're dealing with is a domain event? What should be external? I actually only added this slide into my deck yesterday because someone asked me a question as to, you know, what's the ideal time to use domain events. And their argument was maybe it should only be used when you've got some sort of external asynchronous processing to be done. You know, email's classic, right? What other scenarios are there? What are some of the ones, for those of you who've done domain events, what are some of the ones that you've used? Barcoding. So what's the context there? You kind of put the domain model into a state where it says waiting for scan, and then you fire the event, and then when the message comes back, it updates the domain model. Okay, yep. Long-running transactions. So you kick off the process, your domain model gets persisted and put aside, and then when that processing comes back, you bring it back up and then finish the transaction. Yeah. I mean, the wedding scenario is just like that, isn't it? In that, you know, it could be hours, days, weeks, whatever, between getting that confirmation message back.
When you've got a command in CQR, that's a process,
that command that you want to go to other external, other things, then. Yep. So an acronym was mentioned there, CQRS. Who's actually heard of that before? Okay. So the idea behind CQRS is that you optimize the design of your application so you have one set of services that the code consumes which reads data, so it's optimized for the viewing, and then you have another set of APIs that your code uses which is optimized for acting on the system, in a lot of cases manipulating the domain model. So it's that's really as simple as it is. But what's happened is that people have come up with this architecture and they've said, okay, well, every single time we put a command in, we want that to be dispatched on something like nService bus and process asynchronously. And what a lot of people will say is we want that to execute asynchronously and eventually the actual underlying data store will be consistent. It doesn't actually have to be executed asynchronously. You can do synchronous execution of commands. It just depends on what the business will accept. Sometimes if you can execute something asynchronously, you can eke a little bit more scalability out of your application. But if you're going to be looking at domain events, I'd actually strongly recommend that you look at CQRS as a concept and then potentially nService bus as a way of implementing part of that concept.
Does that mean that
your
domain you fetched is
back to
state memory?
So when this becomes a timing issue, right? So yeah, so you might actually have to make sure that you persist. So there's a couple of different ways of handling this, right? And actually, this is why we get onto the reactive framework pretty quickly. What you can do is actually you can push all of those domain events into a queue, persist your domain model, and then process the domain events after the data has been persisted back to the database. And that's where using something like reactive framework might be useful, because you can actually get better control of your persistence versus the asynchronous background execution. I've seen some people build applications where they fire off their domain events, they do all their processing with the domain model, finish the transaction, and then just unleash the domain events, and they go and execute asynchronously behind the scenes. Timing is an issue. So being a consultant, I have this, I've got this crutch that I fall back onto, and it depends. I would really need to understand the specific scenario. As few as possible, right? You don't want to write much more code than you need, but I don't think there's a general measure. I think you'd actually end up with you'd have to have a fairly large domain model to have that many, unless you've got an entity which just happens to have lots of child entities hanging off it, and you want to fire domain events for changes on those. And you would only create the domain events when you actually had justification for some external thing to act upon that information anyway. So, if you've got 50 domain events, what you're saying is that when something happens in your application, there's 50 points where something external to that domain model could take place. Yeah, you can use it to interact between domain models. That's the problem that it solves, right? There's no reason that you couldn't fire domain events to then go sort of re-enter your domain model. But the reason, particularly in this context, that I introduced the concept of domain events is to deal with those external dependencies that you don't want your domain model to know about. It's the instance I used to solve it, but I can't see any reason why you wouldn't use it for solving other problems. But I would be asking the question, there's no point introducing that sort of asynchronous execution or even synchronous execution, because it just adds complexity. Right. Unless, like you said, you're talking across two bounded contexts, but another bounded context is kind of like an external dependency anyway.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Is basically, those domain events is around your different domain scope, so billing to customer service reservations. That's the general area that your domain event should be, and of course, things
like the email. That's right, but I consider, and so mentally in my head, I sort of say, I say that if I'm talking to another context, I kind of consider that to be external. I've kind of limited the size of my domain here for a reason. I don't want to create any tight coupling, so I just sort of pass as little information across those boundaries as possible. Well, so if you were going to do that, you would actually end up taking dependency on your container. So you'd either inject it at the parent object. Yeah, but then now you're taking dependency on a container or something like that. Which some people do take dependencies on their container. I try to keep my code so it knows nothing about the container that I'm using. It just makes it more transportable. I think what ends up happening is if you do start injecting those objects through the root entities, you end up sort of doing parse a parcel every single time you instantiate a child object, and that becomes the problem. It's not so much injecting it at the top, it's what do you do with it from there. Okay. So the next approach I want to look at is the reactive framework. So actually there's a session on down in Central C after this one where there's going to be a fairly deep dive into the reactive framework. So if you've never seen it before, I'd recommend going and checking it out. Martin Grinnell and Chris Hewitt are doing it. Knowing those two, it'll bend your brain a bit. I'd recommend. I'm actually going to, after I finish this, I'm going to go down there and check it out. So I've been watching Martin debug some of his code the last couple of days, and it's been interesting to watch. Okay, so let's look at reactive framework, which is the one that I saw previously. Let's try this one. Okay, so if we look at the reactive framework, what I've done is inside my wedding object, it's pretty much the same, but what I've got is a subject. Now, a subject in reactive framework terminology is something that's both a publisher and a subscriber. And so, I have to say, I'm not a reactive framework expert. I use this as a tool. And so, I've got this object, and then when a guest is invited, I basically put that invitation into that object. And so, from there, reactive framework expressions can sort of pull that data out and route it into different parts of the application. And because the reactive framework has some nice sort of threading architectures and allows you to deal with asynchronicity, It's similar in approach to using the EDN domain events class and service bus, but without the distributed nature. So it's really just about more about the asynchronicity. And so all I'm doing is when I invite someone to the wedding, I've still got the guest invited event, but it's not really an event args from a .NET events point of view. And I push that by calling on next, passing in that object. Okay, and then in my controller, I've passed in the wedding repository and the email invitation service, and in the context of my invite guest class action, I'm creating a subscription. So I'm calling subscribe on guest invited, passing in the email invitation service or a method that actually calls it, and that gives me an iDisposable object which I can use for the context of that operation. And rain, hail, shine, when I drop out of that method, it's going to unwind that subscription. All right? So it manages the scope, and you can actually do that inside the HTTP context as well. The domain events class can do that as well, but I actually quite like this model just personally from a code point of view. It seems more natural because it's using something that's really part of the .NET framework. Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it's the same thing. The thing I like about it is it gives you this handle that you can then unsubscribe. So you've got this explicit thing that you can dispose. Whereas with events, you kind of got to roll that error handling code yourself. So you've got to have the sort of try, catch, finally, whatever. And you've obviously got to deal with the threading issues as well on top of this. Okay, so that's the overall architecture. Now, the next thing I wanted to go on to was really talking about testing. Actually, while we're at it, who's got a preference? Out of what you've seen so far, domain events, EDN's code, reactive framework, what do you like? Anyone thought of doing it with a reactive framework before? Yeah, you like... where you've got sort of a distributed application where one part of the application might be processing something else. Yeah, I actually think that as much as it's a pain, the .NET events thing is quite nice in that if you do want to be able to fire off an event synchronously and get some data back from the external dependency, it's probably the nicest way of doing that. It's kind of a standard .NET pattern, but then you've got to deal with the the nasties of .NET events as well. So it's one of those things where you've got three different approaches, you'll probably come up with more. You just look at your problem and figure out what's going to make sense for your application. I probably wouldn't recommend using all of them at once in an application. Pick one that's going to meet most of your requirements and then live with some of the headaches for some particular circumstances. Okay. How am I going for time? 2, 3, 4. Sorry? Okay, cool. All right, I'll go fast. Some of the things you should consider, the location of the handlers. So if you're subscribing things, are they a global thing? Are they local to the action result? Are they local to the controller? If we're talking about MVC, obviously other application frameworks will be different. And what's the life cycle of that event processing? So are you going to defer execution of that event processing until a later time after you've persisted that record down to the database? That might mean that you probably move towards something more like the reactive framework because you get better control over that processing of that pipeline. Okay. All right. TDD versus BDD. I sort of threw this in here because the whole point of improving these application architectures is so that it makes it easier to test particular scenarios within your applications. And if you're doing a complex domain model, you actually really do need to test it. In fact, last night I was writing some code to replace this demo, actually, and I stumbled across a whole bunch of bugs as I started building out the test cases and trying out different things. So it really does work. If you've got a fairly complex domain, doing good TDD and BDD practices will actually help. But what are they really? So we've probably all heard of test-driven development. This is that sort of concept where we write unit tests, they fail, we fix up the code so that it passes, and then we keep refactoring it until we're sort of happy with the code. And so when we define our unit tests, we actually end up with this situation where in the unit test code, arrange, act, assert. We arrange the dependencies of what we're going to be doing. We act with those dependencies, and we assert that something's going to take place. BDD is actually just good TDD, or a form of good TDD, where TDD makes you think about the API, so you're sort of structuring code and you start exercising the API. BDD forces you to start thinking about the business context in which your code's operating. To give you a working example, if I look at the test code, which is pretty simple in this application, I've got my wedding test code here. So I'm arranging my code, all my dependencies. I'm acting on it, such as... so you can start that. That's a fairly simple test there. Let's see if I've got... I've just got some simple logic there. In fact, this is a really good example. I'm looking through this code and I'm thinking, why am I bothering to test half of this stuff? I'm just testing the API. I'm just driving the API. I'm not really testing the business logic of the application. So BDD is really about changing your mindset. Whether you don't use a BDD framework or not. Yes. Yep. What I've got here is a simple extension to MS Test, which is what I'm actually using here, which allows you to write tests. So you can say, given a precondition and some other preconditions, when something takes place, then these things should be true. Okay. So I'm actually describing the business context a little bit more. I'm being forced to describe it in plain English. And then what I do is I go through and start to provide the concrete implementation of this code. So you can see here that I've taken that and now I'm just writing expressions which exercise the API to meet those business requirements that I've written. If you're going to be doing domain-driven design, instead of thinking about how you're going to test that API, think about how you're going to prove that that domain model solves the business problem. And BDD is just a tool to do that. This is just a framework. So what I do here is I subclass the specification class, and I decorate it with some metadata. And when I run the test, so if I run this test, some of these are plain old MS tests, and some of these are also more sort of BDD style. I can jump in on that, and it tells me what my scenario is and whether I've actually implemented that code or not. And I just go through and create the implementation that defines that particular test. The takeaway is not using MS Test Contrib or any particular BDD framework. The takeaway is you need to change it when you're doing domain-driven development. The takeaway is to change the way you think about the code that you're testing. You know, you're actually almost like walking through a business process rather than checking every single input and output of a particular object. Right? So you might test those things as far as they're important to the business process that you're particularly testing. Give you a more concrete example that I was playing with yesterday, and this is a BDD style test without a BDD framework. Okay, so this is a domain model about accreditation, so I'll just bring it up. So my ubiquitous language is I've got this concept of an accreditation, which is something that's issued by an authority. As a person, I can register to have that accreditation, and that accreditation has a currency, so I am either current in that accreditation or not. And so that's defined as the coverage. So currency is the sort of true-false flag, and coverage is, you know, from this date to this date, I have that accreditation. And then I have, you know, a status and a status reason, and accreditation equivalence, and this concept of a job. And a job is, say, driving a truck, I need to have a Victorian, a Vic Roads light rigid driver's license, as an example. So the business process that I want to validate is job suitability. So instead of having a job test or a person test or an accreditation test, I have a job suitability test. And what I'm doing is in my code is I'm saying person with appropriate registration is determined to be suitable. So I instantiate my objects. It's still that same arrange, act, assert, but what I'm testing is the business process. I'm walking through it because when you issue a job to someone, you want to make sure that they're actually licensed to perform that job. That's the change in thinking between TDD and BDD. A lot of people, when they go into doing behavior-driven development, they look first for a framework, and then they're kind of dragged into this different way of thinking. You can actually do behavior-driven style testing with any testing framework you like, any sort of unit testing framework. It's just about the mental shift. Okay. Probably harped on that long enough. Okay. Okay. So probably, you know, once you have started doing BDD, and I would actually also say that, you know, testing your email service, don't use BDD, right? It's pointless. You end up bending, driving the API to... If you've got an API and you really want to test the API, then do TDD. But if you are doing BDD, you might want to consider a framework. I don't have a particular recommendation. You know, in the Ruby space, there's been lots of things like RSpec and that kind of stuff, which seem to have been taken off. In the .NET space, there's been lots of replication, spec flow, that kind of stuff. Some of them have really great features, and they get to one thing, and it just drives you nuts. Try them all. Seriously. You'll find one that you like. The reason I wrote MS Test Contrib is I couldn't find one I liked, and now I've implemented MS Test Contrib. I now respect the authors of the other ones a lot more. So, okay. Okay, finishing the job, getting to persistence. So, persistence is actually fairly easy once you've gone this far. Let's get to the point where I'm shutting down. Okay, there we go. So, we've kind of ignored where we're putting this data all the way along. And so if we go in here, we've got our mock repository. That's the wrong one. feel the heat coming out of my laptop here. All these copies of Visual Studio and ReSharper running. It's melting my pass. Okay, so we've got our repositories, and hopefully I've got the right one here. So I've got my wedding repository. And this repository is very simple, right? And I am an advocate of making repositories concrete rather than having a generic repository class that you use and you end up with operations which really have no place with that particular object. I actually recommend that you implement each one in a concrete way. Now, you might have a base class just to give you some basic functionality, like getting by a particular ID, but that's probably about as far as you go, maybe saving an operation as well. But always have a concrete implementation. And so if I look at my Entity Framework wedding repository, I'm actually using code first. So I pass in a wedding context, which is a code first object, where I'm exposing a DB set of weddings. And I'm using the code first model builder to sort of spec out how I want this thing persisted in the database. So now if I run this application, I think this actually persists to a local SQL table, but hey, look, ReSharper. Okay, run the application. So in this case, I have no sample data in this particular database. I think I've created it on the fly. So I create the new object, create the wedding, send out an invitation. Okay, invite guest. There we go. There's my emails. Okay, and I could continue the workflow, but you get the point. Once you do a good domain model, really what you want to do is just do the minimum amount of work necessary to get that data, the data you need, persisted into the database. And you might find in a lot of cases that your domain model carries a lot more information around with it temporarily than it actually ends up in your database. Things like, you know, temporary status information, which can be inferred. Okay. All right. Okay. There's the context initializer, which creates the database. And everything else in the code base hasn't really changed at all, except in my global ASAX, where instead of wiring up a mock Entity Framework wedding repository, I'm actually injecting a real one that talks to the database. So that's pretty much it. Just one comment I would make is if you are implementing a mock repository just during your initial development, one thing to watch out for is that if you're holding these objects in memory, it's not the same as persisting it to the database. The lifetime of the objects is not the same. So you will get some weird bugs. You need to kind of consider that as you're designing it. Sometimes it's actually worth artificially serializing the objects to some kind of bucket so you can simulate that sort of offline storage scenario, or somehow cloning them if you can. But cloning can be a little bit time-consuming to implement. And that's it for me, unless there's questions and comments and, you know, discussion. So we've got a little bit of time. So domain-driven design sort of says that you work from that model down. That's the whole point of it. If you do have to work from the database up, so what you want to do is produce an API that represents your database that you can talk to quite neatly, what you might do is in your repository, where your repository deals with domain model objects coming into it, you then might do some kind of mapping into the database objects that go back to the database. Yeah. But, yeah.
I don't know, in my experience, it's always been not practical, especially if we're controlling the data model and the main model, because you've got exactly kind of the one-to-many problem. You've got that already sorted out.
If, So if your application is truly CRUD and you're just dealing with sort of hierarchical relationships and there's no complexities or interdependencies between those children objects, like you can only have one thing of this particular type, or if you add this, then you go over some kind of threshold. So there's no real complex domain logic. Then yeah, use those basically database up tools to develop the application. Domain-driven design is a tool to deal with complex software rather than try and apply it to simple software. So if I was going to build an application just to maintain a list of tasks, I wouldn't use domain-driven design. There's just no point. Yep. So this is where domain-driven design comes into play, right? So because I can only add a guest through the wedding object can implement the logic to check to see whether that guest has already been added. So because you're using, in that particular case, because you're using an ORM, you've populated that object. You would do a query on your guests based on some filter criteria, and it would route that query down into the database. It doesn't. So from your implementation point of view, it doesn't, but the ORM has actually injected the ability to query down into the database so you can sort of lazily load that data. If you didn't do that, every single time you downloaded the wedding, you'd actually have to fetch every single record. So ORMs solve that particular lazy loading problem. You'd actually have to fire out some kind of event to fetch it. So, but I guess my argument would be if you're doing that, you're probably doing it the hard way. It should always have a collection of guests, but I think that you're really talking here about you might have a stored procedure which is used to fetch the data, which you can't easily map onto. So when you fetch the data, when you return that wedding object from the... When you return that wedding object from the repository, you'd actually have to wire up your object so it could handle lazy loading instead of the ORM. I'm having trouble hearing, so I'll have to talk to you after. Sorry. Thank you, guys.